Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. Here's a story that appeared recently in USA Today. Death Valley in California, now covered with colorful wildflowers in bloom. What to know? Folks are flocking to Death Valley National Park in California to take in the sights of wildflowers. Many are calling it a super bloom, which is a rare event, but officials have not confirmed that. By Julia Gomez. Death Valley, the hottest area of America, is exploding with color and experiencing a high concentration of blooming flowers, the National Park Service, NPS, stated on their website. Although many are calling this a super bloom, this has yet to be officially confirmed. USA Today has reached out to the NPS for comment. While wildflowers can pop up in the valley every year, a super bloom is a rare and special treat that attracts different pollinators, like butterflies, moths, bees, and hummingbirds that may not have visited Death Valley otherwise, states the National Park's website. A good wildflower year depends on at least three things: well-spaced rainfall throughout the fall, winter, and spring, sufficient warmth from the sun, and lack of drying winds, says the NPS. Apparently, 2024 had exactly what the dry valley needed to fill it with gold, purple, pink, or white flowers. So when was the last super bloom in Death Valley? According to NPS, the last three super blooms occurred in the following years, 2016, 2005, and 1998. So what is a super bloom? Super blooms in Death Valley are rare events that happen around once every 10 years. They can occur anywhere, but when conditions are just right, carpets of wildflowers form all over Death Valley. What makes a super bloom? In order for a super bloom to happen, the NPS states there needs to be at least half an inch of rain, which washes off the seed's protective coating. Then, for those seeds to grow, rainstorms need to occur at an even interval between winter and spring. The best blooms are triggered by an early winter-type rainstorm in September or October, followed by an El Niño weather pattern that brings above-average rainfall to the desert southwest, states the NPS's website. Super blooms also need winds that dry out the soil to remain at bay. According to its website, frequent windstorms that are not accompanied by rain will dehydrate the soil and the plants before they get a chance to bloom. Can I pick wildflowers at Death Valley? No, in a national park, regulations prohibit people from picking wildflowers that might produce seeds for the following wildflower season. What is Death Valley? Death Valley is not only the hottest, but the lowest and driest point in all of America, according to Britannica, which is part of the reason why the super blooms are so rare and need absolutely perfect conditions to occur. The National Park is located in southeastern California and is about 2 hours west of Las Vegas. And staying with things to see out of state, here's an article that appeared in USA Today, Saving Stumpy, How Residents in Washington Scramble to Save This One Cherry Tree, by Sybil Mays Osterman. The nation's capital is prematurely grieving over the expected loss of Stumpy, the city's favorite little cherry tree on the tidal basin. But a plan to give the little tree new life by growing its clippings at the National Arboretum is giving new hope to Stumpy's devoted fan base, even those engaged in an online campaign to save Stumpy. For years, natives and visitors to the district alike have marveled at the annual resurgence of Stumpy's blooms. True to name, Stumpy is not much more than a stump, but its size doesn't stop its small tangle of branches from bursting into bloom, along with the other cherry trees on the tidal basin, as Washington takes in the beauty of its cherry blossoms every spring. But news of a planned rehabilitation of the tidal basin threatened to spell the end of Stumpy's days. Last month, the National Park Service announced the project would require the uprooting of 158 cherry trees on the tidal basin and some banks of the Potomac River, Stumpy included. The Park Service said the removal, slated for the late spring or early summer, is required to defend the remaining cherry trees against aging infrastructure and rising sea levels, but that hasn't stopped Stumpy fans from rallying for its salvation. Hope for Stumpy's survival seemed dim, but a new collaboration between the National Arboretum in Washington, D.C. and the National Park Service to grow clones of Stumpy could allow the tree to live on in new form. The plan will see horticulturalists plant clippings from Stumpy's living parts on the Arboretum's grounds. Eventually, the trees could be returned to the tidal basin and replanted. Meanwhile, the original Stumpy, along with the other removed trees, will be mulched and returned to the National Mall, providing root protection and enriching the soil for living trees for generations to come, according to National Park Service Chief of Communications, Mike Litterst. U.S. Arboretum hopes to grow Stumpy's genetic matches. Creating a genetic match of a tree is nothing new for the National Arboretum's horticulturalists. What doesn't come every day is a chance to work on plant material that's achieved celebrity status, says Piper Settle, a horticulturalist at the Arboretum. Settle said the Park Service reached out to the Arboretum last winter to share Stumpy's story and make a plan to preserve its legacy. They knew, at that time, that transplanting was unlikely and maybe not feasible, and so that's why they came to us, she said. The Arboretum's horticulturalists hope to preserve Stumpy's genetic material by collecting clippings from the little tree to be planted and grown on the Arboretum's grounds in a process called propagation. The new Stumpy will be grown in a propagation greenhouse, a special area with a controlled environment designed to help the new plants grow. If successful, in around a year, cuttings from the new growth would be transferred to their own individual pots to grow out. Ideally, in 2 to 3 years, we would hand them back to the National Park Service, provided that they were ready to receive them, Settle said. It's too early to say how many Stumpy clones will survive, but the Arboretum hopes to hand at least 3 healthy trees back to the Park Service, according to Settle. The Arboretum used the same process to preserve Stumpy's ancestors. Horticulturalists planted clippings from the tidal basin's original cherry trees that were gifts of friendship from Japan in 1912. Those trees, which are now among the Arboretum's cherry tree collection, also serve to replenish the tidal basin's supply. While they offer great aesthetic value as flowering cherry trees, it's also a dual purpose in that we house them here as backups for the tidal basin, Settle said. So in essence, we would hope to do the same with Stumpy. Still, Stumpy isn't out of the woods yet. The success of the process partially depends on horticulturalists taking clippings during the optimal annual propagation window for cherry trees around mid-May to mid-June. The fact that Stumpy is so stumpy and has like 3 scraggly branches and may not put out that much new growth this spring, and even the new growth that it does put out might not be considered optimal. I mean, all these factors add up, Settle said. There's no guarantee. Already, the Arboretum has heard from many concerned citizens in search of more information about what will happen to their beloved tree. A lot of people have questions about why the project is happening and how we might be involved, Settle said. There's been a big outcry from the public. Settle said the Arboretum does not take the care and keeping of Stumpy's genetic material lightly. We're pretty honored to be able to not only participate, but we're offering an opportunity to continue Stumpy's story. So hopefully, this will be the next chapter. Amanda Rhodes, 31, is the author of a Change.org petition calling on authorities to reconsider their decision to cut down Stumpy, the cherished little tree that could. Within the community in D.C., this tree is so beloved. Every single person knows who Stumpy is, she said, and not only have I gotten good feedback from the local people, I have had people share it across the country. Rhodes, who lives nearby, has greeted Stumpy regularly for years during her morning walks before starting her work day as a clinical psychologist. I can't do the walk without doing the tidal basin and saying hi to Stumpy, she said. Over the years, the steadfast and unwavering little tree captured her heart. If you look at Stumpy, it doesn't look like he's going to blossom at all, and yet every single year he has the most beautiful bloom. When Rhodes learned of the tragic news, she immediately put out calls to the National Arboretum and the National Park Service, offering to fundraise towards Stumpy's replanting. Although Rhodes was happy to learn of the plan to grow Stumpy's clones, she still pleaded with the National Arboretum to consider attempting to replant Stumpy despite the little tree's fragile condition. If it's going to be anyone that's able to do it, it's them, she said. We hope that they consider the possibility of attempting something like this so that we can continue on Stumpy's tradition in a way that allows us to go and visit him in his current state. On the subject of trees, here's an article called Steer Clear of Planting These Troublesome Trees in Your Yard by Mia Perlman. The fast-growing, hassle-free tree known as the Leland cypress is similar to a Christmas tree. These trees come in so many different varieties, and most people plant them to give their yard some privacy. Keeping that in mind, you would think they are ideal for yards. However, this is not the case. Leland cypress trees grow too large and too fast for yards and can easily get uprooted during storms, creating a safety hazard for homes nearby. While privacy is nice to have, there are better and safer ways to achieve it than planting these trees. Also, they are susceptible to many types of fungi, which can cause even more safety hazards. Bradford pear tree flowers, also known as the calorie pear. Bradford pear trees are native to Asia and are found in the eastern region of the U.S. However, they didn't initially grow in America. Instead, they were imported and commonly planted around homes in the 1960s. While these trees are known for their beautiful white flowers, they smell foul. Since the tree grows over 50 feet tall, the smell takes over any space around it. So if you want to keep your yard or garden smelling fresh, Bradford pear trees are not for you. They might be pretty, but their smell is deadly. Next on the list is black walnut trees. There's nothing worse than toxic chemicals in your garden or yard. Unfortunately, black walnut trees, also known as Juglans nigra, produce toxins that can destroy an entire space of greenery. One of the most harmful toxins in question is jugione, which can stunt the growth of grass and some vegetables. To sustain a yard with black walnut trees, you would have to replace your plants with jugione-resistant ones, which is a lot of work. The problem can be reduced by removing the fallen trees and nuts from the tree, but it is not worth the gamble of ruining an entire green space. Mimosa trees. The bright color of mimosa trees might be enticing, but they are not worth the trouble. Mimosa trees are native to the Middle East and China. Finally, mimosa trees were brought to the United States. Unfortunately, these fast-growing trees are short-lived, draw insects, including webworms and moths, and are prone to breakage. In addition, they produce 6-inch-long seedling pods that germinate quickly even through the winter months. If you aren't careful, they will take over your green space. If we're being honest, it's safer to stick with planting other trees instead. Sweet gum trees. Sweet gum trees are native to the southeastern part of the United States. Popular back in the 1940s, sweet gums were straight tall trees with single trunks that could reach 75 feet. While they offer lovely autumn leaves, their seeds are problematic. Their seedling pods have tough, spiny exteriors, making them challenging to remove from unwanted spaces. Sweet gums also attract birds and have invasive roots. So not only would they threaten your garden, but they also threaten patios, driveways, and building foundations. Any gardener knows that the risks with sweet gums just aren't worth the hassle. Magnolia trees. Magnolias are widely beloved for their broad, white flowers. But if you are so enamored with them that you consider planting one in your yard, you will also probably want to rethink that idea. Magnolias require a lot of maintenance, and you'll always have to keep an eye on them. These trees attract many insects, including caterpillars, thrips, and aphids, that will cause the tree's leaves to fall prematurely. These plants shed all year long anyway, so if you don't want to deal with these high-maintenance trees, it's best not to plant them. Ginkgo trees. Commonly known as ginkgo biloba and maidenhair, these trees provide colorful, unique foliage unique to their kind. Not only that, they are pest and drought resistant and are known for their attractive shape. But gardeners who want to protect their greenery should get male ginkgo, not female. These trees drop fruits that can cause pollution, and cleaning it is timely. Male ginkgo species don't have this issue. So if you want a ginkgo tree, just make sure do your research first, otherwise you might regret it. Next on the list of trees you want to steer clear of planting in your yard, silver maple trees, one of the most common trees in North America. If you are American, odds are you've seen tons of silver maples planted in residential neighborhoods. However, they can cause more harm than good. These trees are easy to grow, but hard to kill. The roots are invasive and can destroy sidewalks and clog water lines and landscapes, if that weren't enough. Besides robbing other plants of nutrients, they take up a lot of space that other less harmful plants could use. Either way, spare yourself the trouble and don't waste your time planting these trees. Red oak trees is next. Northern red oak trees have elegant large leaves. Though these leaves are pretty and garner a lot of attention, they're also why these trees are not suitable for gardens and yards. Red oaks shed leaves and drop tiny flowers and catkins, especially in the autumn and spring. Besides their falling leaves, they attract insects, bacteria, and fungi. Therefore, though they are good for streets, they are not suitable for fields or yards unless you want to have a cleanup after these trees constantly. Otherwise, there are other trees out there to consider. Tree of Heaven. You would think that this tree would be heavenly with the name Tree of Heaven. Despite the name, these trees are anything but, especially when it comes to planting them in a garden or backyard. Trees of Heaven, also called Ailanthus altissima, are rapidly growing trees native to China. The problem with these plants is that they grow too quickly to contain and can't consume other plants. In addition, they produce many seeds, putting vegetation in harm's way. Birch trees are next on the list. Commonly known as the genus Betula, birch trees are known for their white bark, but once you plant them, nothing will grow near them. These slim trees contain shallow roots that harden soil and consume surrounding space. Unfortunately, this problem can't be solved because if you chop the roots off, it defeats the purpose. While this problem is evident, another issue is that birch trees attract pests. So unless you want a yard full of birches and pesky creatures, avoiding these trees is your best option. Ash trees. Ash trees are known for their advantages. They are resilient and rapidly growing, and they sport beautiful, luscious green leaves. But they are threatened by emerald ash borers, a type of beetle. These monstrous creatures have destroyed millions of these trees, and who wants these pests in their yard? Currently, there are treatment options for ash trees impacted by these beetles, but no cure for their destruction. If you want an ash tree, you have to go through a lot to keep them alive and well. These plants are not for you if you don't have the time. Weeping willow trees. Anyone would think weeping willows are sad or imply something sad based on the name, but they get their name from their droopy leaves. Weepy willows, or Babylon willows, come from Asia and were often traded along the Silk Road across Southwest Asia and Europe. While many think their droopy leaves might be the problem, it's their roots. Willows have aggressive roots that are known to damage pavement and water lines. In addition, the roots absorb soil's water, which could endanger other plants. The bad outweighs the good with weeping willows, and they would just cause complications for any yard. Russian olive trees. At first glance, Russian olive trees look like they would complement any garden. But the more you know about them, the less growing a Russian olive tree sounds like a good idea. Russian olive trees have silvery leaves and cool colored trunks, but they suffocate other plants. When birds eat the fruits growing off these trees, their seeds spread, and these trees multiply and consume the area. Similar to other olive trees, Russian olives are hard to kill. They also resprout and are invasive. Do yourself a favor and don't even consider letting these trees inhabit your yard. Sycamore trees. Sycamore trees are lovely to look at for parts of the season, but they make a big mess. These trees are infamous for dirtying the area around them with seeds and leaves. In addition, sycamores are prone to fungal infections, which results in them dropping more leaves. As a result, there's virtually no way to clean up after them. During the summer months, these trees turn white and become inhabited by lace bugs. These trees are ugly in these months and cover yards in debris. If we're being honest, it's hard to see the bright side of planting these trees. Mulberry trees. Any gardener's worst nightmare is rotting fruit and pests growing in their garden. Mulberry trees are medium-sized deciduous trees that produce small fruits in the summer season. These fruits rot when they ferment and attract pests, including fruit flies. Fruit flies are terrible because they could wander into your home from your yard and cause more damage there. Besides this, mulberry trees, mainly white mulberries, develop aggressive roots which can crack pavement. If you need another, that's just one more reason to avoid planting them. Next on the list is aspen trees, of trees to avoid planting. Aspen trees are native to cold regions with cool summers, including North America. Aspen trees are also known as quaking aspen trees because they quake or tremble in the wind due to their flattened trunk and branches. These plants are beautiful, considering their leaves change from a basic green to golden and yellow tones. but if planted in a yard or garden, they could be dangerous. Aspen trees are known to overgrow and spread wildfires. Additionally, their tree roots can impact plumbing systems, so it's best to avoid these trees altogether before something dreadful happens. Lombardy poplar trees. Lombardy poplar trees are fast-growing trees that can grow up to 6 feet a year. They are a popular choice for yards because they give people privacy as they grow. Best known for their column-like form, these plants are also famous for their susceptibility to damage. Between the insects and diseases that these trees attract, Lombardy poplar trees always look damaged and unhealthy. They require maintenance, mainly since female Lombardy poplars produced masses of cottony seeds. Landscaping professionals dislike these trees, and for this reason, among others, people should not plant them in their yards. Mountain cedar trees. Allergies impact people year-round, but most people tend to feel the worst during the spring and fall seasons. This is when plants that set off allergy triggers are in full bloom. One of the worst plants for people prone to allergies is the mountain cedar tree. These pollen bombs are found in the south and central regions of the United States. These bushy trees release pollen at wide ranges, which would impact you and your neighbors. If you or anyone you know has any outdoor allergies, living with this tree will be a nightmare. All right, and those of you who listen to this show on a regular basis know we feature stories each week from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called My Mother's Cure. It was written by Jean Jeffrey Geetson, and there's a quote here from Lou Erickson. Gardening requires lots of water, most of it in the form of perspiration. My mother's cure. To break the spell of a long, cold Minnesota winter, my mother and I pored over seed catalogs, making plans for a garden. Maybe we should plant tomatoes, my mother suggested. Grandma had good luck with tomatoes. Wish I could remember what she said about growing tomatoes. Maybe it will come to me. I hope we have better luck with tomatoes than we did last year with flowers, I grumbled. Ever since I had turned 15 in the fall, I seemed to grumble about everything. Oh, come on, Jeannie, cheer up. We'll have lots of fun in our tomato garden. It'll be a real mother-daughter project. Two by two, we'll see them through, from seeds to soup, my mother said, adding a little soft shoe step to her words. When the precious seeds came to our house, my mother sowed them in what she called a baby flat. When they grew too big for that flat, she transplanted them into bigger flats. 60 plants, she exclaimed. Why, we've got our work cut out for us this summer, that's for sure. How many tomatoes do you think we'll get from each plant? I asked, looking dubiously at the spindly little things. Well, if we had a bigger plot, we'd have hundreds. But the yard is too small for that. We'll have to stake them. That way we'll decrease the number of tomatoes per plant. It will mean we'll have to trim some kiddos from each mother plant. Oh, Mom, I wailed, that sounds horrible. Oh, don't be silly, Jeannie, Mom said with a touch of impatience. Honestly, you teenagers are all alike. The merest little thing and you go into hysterics. A summer of good hard work will be the cure for what ails you. As soon as there's no longer any danger of frost, we'll get these plants outside. It was barely daylight one Saturday morning when my mother yanked me out of bed. As she tossed me a pair of overalls and a trowel, she said, "We haven't a minute to lose. Weatherman says we're in for rain by mid-morning. Let's get those plants in so they can soak up that nice spring rain." I kept up a constant stream of complaints as I worked along with my mother. She brushed them all aside with a song, she said, Grandma always sang when they gardened together. Just wish I could remember what she said, though, about growing tomatoes. Might still come to me as we go along here, two by two, from seeds to soup. My mother was relentless in her cure for whatever it was that ailed me that summer. I'd barely recovered from my planting experience when she informed me that it was time to hoe and weed our garden plot. If we weren't hoeing and weeding, we were warding off cutworms by wrapping the bases of the plants with paper. The more I griped about all the hard work, the louder my mother sang about the joys of working together. As the summer slipped away, out came the canning equipment. We spent a long, boring weekend boiling and rinsing each item with great care. We'll have to labor away on Labor Day, Mom said. I wouldn't want to waste even one tomato. We'll have tomato juice. Some we'll can whole and some we'll boil down for soup. And I have the recipe for Grandma's chili. I sure wish I could remember what it was she said about growing tomatoes. Still hasn't come to me. Oh, say, Jeannie, run down the street, will you, and get Mrs. Nelson's mason jars? She has a sack set aside for me. I barely recognized the boy who opened the Nelsons' back door. Could that really be Eddie, the Nelsons' grandson? Where was the gangly, awkward Eddie of last summer? I was so stunned by his movie star good looks, I felt a peppy tune building up inside me. When I stumbled down the steps, Eddie offered to carry the sack of jars and walk me home. When my mother saw him, she was as surprised as I had been. She stammered out something about fixing iced tea. "Are you here for the Labor Day weekend?" she asked, when I was unable to break the silence. Yes, Eddie blushed. "I'm going to the academy this year, and I'm here early for football practice. I'll be living with my grandparents while I go to school." "Isn't that wonderful?" my mother glowed. "Yeah, it's great," Eddie said. "We're having a team picnic on Labor Day. Gene, maybe you'd like to come with me. I mean, if you're free Labor Day," Eddie concluded, looking directly at me. I looked around at the kitchen counters, heaped high with tomatoes and canning equipment, gazed with great pain at the sack of mason jars, and dared not meet my mother's eye. I had been by her side all summer. She had met my gripes and sass with as much love and care as she had lavished on her tomatoes. She had wanted us to be a mother-daughter team, seeing this project through from seeds to soup. But I hoped she would realize how much I wanted to go to that picnic. At the same time, I hated to think of her working alone in our kitchen, humming and singing her little tunes to herself. My mother took off her glasses and wiped them slowly on a corner of her apron. Surveying the kitchen counters, she seemed to be looking far beyond the tomatoes and canning equipment. Perhaps that is why she said softly, "I remember now what Grandma said about growing tomatoes. She said children and tomatoes grow much too quickly, but at least you can preserve tomatoes when they blossom." In a stronger voice, my mother added, "Of course, Jean, you may go to the picnic. I'm sure you two will have a wonderful time." I was so happy I couldn't speak a word, so I couldn't thank my mother until after Eddie left. I was smiling, beaming for the first time in months. I kissed my mother and I kissed every tomato within reach. And then I thanked my lucky stars I had a mother who knew how to raise tomatoes and a daughter. That's called My Mother's Cure, written by Jean Jeffrey Geetson, one of the many stories that make up Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.